Love Potion. And in Prisoner of Azkaban, Mrs. Weasley tells her daughter Ginny and Hermione Granger about a love potion she made as a young girl. But in Half-Blood Prince, we find several significant references to love potions. The first happens in Diagon Alley at Weasley's Wizard Wheeze's Fred and George's magic shop. Near the window was an array of violently pink products, around which a cluster of excited girls was giggling enthusiastically. Hermione and Ginny both hung back, looking wary.
"There you go," said Fred proudly. "Best range of love potions you'll find anywhere."
Ginny raised an eyebrow skeptically.
"Do they work?" she asked.
"Certainly they work, for up to 24 hours at a time, depending on the weight of the boy in question. And the attractiveness of the girl," said George, reappearing suddenly at their side.
So, in Harry's world, love potions are legal, apparently work only on males, although this isn't explicitly stated, vary in potency depending on the weight of the boy and the attractiveness of the girl, and work for only a limited time without a fresh dose. The next appearance of love potions comes at Hogwarts, in the newly installed Professor Slughorn's potions classroom, where Hermione's showing her stuff.
"Now, this one here..." "Yes, my dear," said Slughorn, now looking slightly bemused as Hermione's hand punched the air again.
"Is that Mortentia?"
"It is indeed. It seems almost foolish to ask," said Slughorn, who was looking mightily impressed. "But I assume you know what it does."
"It's the most powerful love potion in the world," said Hermione.
"Quite right. You recognised it, I suppose, by its distinctive mother-of-pearl sheen."
"And the steam rising in characteristic spirals," said Hermione enthusiastically. "And it's supposed to smell differently to each of us, according to what attracts us. And I can smell freshly mown grass and new parchment and..."
But she turned slightly pink and did not complete the sentence. On the next page, Slughorn reveals more about this love potion.
"Amortentia doesn't really create love, of course. It is impossible to manufacture or imitate love. No, this will simply cause a powerful infatuation or obsession. It is probably the most dangerous and powerful potion in this room." "Oh, yes," he said, nodding gravely at Malfoy and Knott, both of whom were smirking skeptically. "When you have seen as much of life as I have, you will not underestimate the power of obsessive love."
Later, in Half-Blood Prince, we learn just how dangerous and powerful a love potion can be when Ron unwittingly eats a box of chocolate cauldrons spiked with love potion and becomes madly infatuated with Romilda Vane. From that episode, we discover that love potions act almost instantaneously, that they cause obsessive thoughts, intense excitement, and violent emotions, that they can strengthen over time, and that they can be cured by means of a simple antidote. So, what kind of person would actually use a love potion? In our final snippet from Half-Blood Prince, we are introduced to one, Voldemort's mother. Little Hangleton. Merope Gaunt, the local tramp's daughter, harbours a secret, burning passion for Tom Riddle, the wealthy squire's son. An unlikely pair, but Merope is a witch whose powers give her a chance to plot her escape from the desperate life she has led for 18 years under the subjugation of her father and brother.
"Can you not think of any measure Merope could have taken to make Tom Riddle forget his muggle companion and fall in love with her instead?"
Albus Dumbledore asks Harry, to which Harry offers two guesses, the Imperious Curse and a love potion. The Imperious Curse, of course, is one of the three unforgivable curses in the magical world. It robs victims of their will and is, as a result, a prime example of how magic in Harry's world can, but must not, be used to manipulate and exploit others, especially the most vulnerable. Love potions, we've seen, aren't illegal in Harry's world. Perhaps they're not considered as dangerous as the Imperious Curse, because they don't last as long, produce only romantic feelings, as opposed to, say, homicidal intentions, and don't result in total control of the affected person. But it's instructive that Harry sees a particular effect and correctly narrows down the likely causes to either the Imperious Curse or a love potion, reminding us of Slughorn's sober warnings of the love potion's dangers. After Harry's two guesses, Dumbledore continues.
Very good. Personally, I am inclined to think that she used a love potion. I am sure it would have seemed more romantic to her, and I do not think it would have been very difficult, some hot day, when Riddle was riding alone, to persuade him to take a drink of water. In any case, within a few months, the village of Little Hangleton enjoyed a tremendous scandal. You can imagine the gossip it caused when the squire's son ran off with a tramp's daughter, Marupi.
Dumbledore continues by engaging in some guesswork.
You see, within a few months of their runaway marriage, Tom Riddle reappeared at the manor house in Little Hangleton without his wife. The rumour flew around the neighbourhood that he was talking of being hoodwinked and taken in. What he meant, I am sure, is that he had been under an enchantment that had now lifted, though I dare say he did not dare use those precise words for fear of being thought insane.
After Harry asks why the love potion stopped working, Dumbledore adds,
Again, this is guesswork, but I believe that Marupi, who was deeply in love with her husband, could not bear to continue enslaving him by magical means. I believe that she made the choice to stop giving him the potion. Perhaps, besotted as she was, she had convinced herself that he would by now have fallen in love with her in return. Perhaps she thought he would stay for the baby's sake. If so, she was wrong on both counts. He left her, never saw her again, and never troubled to discover what became of his son.
Harry then asks again whether it's important to know all of this about Voldemort's past, to which Dumbledore replies,
Very important, I think.
And?
It has everything to do with the prophecy.
What does this love potion narrative add to the story? And what might it have to do with the prophecy about Harry's defeat of Voldemort? Real love or mere infatuation? So, here's a question. Did Merope Gaunt, Voldemort's mother, love Tom Riddle Sr.? She was certainly infatuated with him, attracted to him, willing to go to extraordinary lengths to have him, but did she love him? Dumbledore says she did, but another possible answer is no, and here's the case for it. She didn't love him, or at least she didn't love him very deeply, exactly because she was willing to use a love potion on him. Presumably, a love potion, after all, robs a person of his free will. This is what makes love pills or potions an ideal thought experiment to elicit the recognition that real freedom requires more than doing what we want to do. Doing what we want to do may be necessary for freedom, but it's not sufficient. We must also have the freedom to do otherwise. Tom lacked such libertarian freedom. Some philosophers, including Harry Frankfurt, deny that the ability to do otherwise is necessary for genuine freedom. This view especially appeals to those who think that everything we do is strictly determined by the laws of the physical universe or by the sovereign plan of God. They typically accept compatibilism, the idea that free will is consistent with strict determination of all our actions and choices. Yet even compatibilists will likely deny that Tom Riddle Sr. freely loved Merope. Why? Because even if Tom was doing what he wanted by loving her, he wouldn't have wanted to love her as a result of a magical inducement. How much could Merope have loved Tom if giving him the potion deprived him of his freedom? It wasn't that she loved him too much. She didn't love him enough, if at all. It was selfish of her. She wanted what was in her interests, not his. She may have felt amorous affection or entertained an unhealthy obsession for him, but clearly she did not feel the deep love that respects the true interests and considered preferences of the beloved. Not only did she take away Riddle's freedom, enslaving him by the potion, she robbed him of the chance to grow in the relationship. And I use that term loosely, for although love can be one way, Relationships by their nature are not. Merope didn't create a relationship that provided a context for Riddle to remain committed despite fluctuating feelings, to grow more in love as time goes on, to attain love's deeper reaches after the physical attraction and the initial excitement fade, or to become a better person as the rough edges of his personality get smoothed out in the mutual self-giving of a real and reciprocal loving relationship. No, she subjected him to magic that coerced his will into becoming obsessed with her. She could have treated him like dirt after that, and still he'd go on stupidly relishing and accepting whatever she dealt him, for that's the nature of the potion. This is surely a situation that invites abuse, but it's hardly a paradigm of love. Incidentally, this shows us what's wrong with using a love potion even on oneself to develop feelings for another, a person we perhaps deem worthy of loving. We're inclined to think it's at least not as bad to use a potion on oneself as it is to administer it to another person, because the issue of free will doesn't arise in the same way. By choosing to take the potion, our free will is intact. This isn't obviously correct, but suppose we grant it. Still, there's the other issue of becoming a certain kind of person. Think how easy it would be to take the potion, rather than working hard in the relationship to remain committed despite challenges, and to grow as a person through relational hardships. With all of the challenges removed, we would lose terrific opportunities to become better persons through the relationship. Not his mother's son. I could imagine that sort of story for Merope, and it's the direction I originally anticipated this chapter to go. It's no shock, I had figured, that a character so thoroughly evil and despicable as Voldemort would hail from such troubled beginnings. It's not a stretch that a man who never loved would have come from a loveless union generated and sustained by magic alone. Nor would it be surprising that a character who from his earliest years harbored such fondness for cruelty and domination would have a mother willing to coerce the will of her mate, and a father who would so callously neglect his child after the enchantment lifted. This view of Merope and Voldemort seems to make a good deal of sense. Its only drawback, so far as I can see, is that it's wrong. Especially where Merope is concerned, the contrast between her and Voldemort is far more important than the comparison. Voldemort's problem is not that he's his mother's son, which in many ways he isn't. No, the problem is that Voldemort is more like his grandfather, Marvolo Gaunt, and his ancestor, Salazar Slytherin. My point in excluding Merope from the list is that she illustrates how, in Harry's world, choices, not innate talent or biological ancestry or magical pedigree, most shape characters and destinies. Merope is a character who ought to elicit from us compassion and no small amount of respect. What she did to win Riddle was wrong, and radically so, but good people sometimes do bad things. It's not the occasional misdeed that defines us, but the habitual practice, the settled character, the persistent pattern of choices that put us on our life's trajectory. We are what we consistently do, as Aristotle put it. Her action was wrong, yes, but I'm not convinced she was very bad at all. To the contrary, she shows a remarkable character, all the more so in the face of all the obstacles she had to overcome and the temptations she had to resist. What matters is not merely where she ended up, but also the distance she had to travel to get there. What matters is the ultimate trajectory her life took, and not merely the projected track of her worst decisions. Unfortunately, Voldemort, if anything, ended up following in the footsteps of where his mother was headed until she came to her senses. Whereas she eventually stopped going in the direction of the dark side, he embraced it wholeheartedly. The blood of Slytherin coursed through each of them, but their lives went in diametrically opposite directions. If nothing else, this illustrates once more the primacy of choice in Harry's world. Critics have sometimes complained about the shortage of redeemed characters in the Potter books, but Merope is a prime example of one. A character whose background was as tragic as anyone's, whose capacity for misusing magic was as great as anyone's, whose temptations to engage in the dark arts were as strong as anyone's,
yet whose life showed that not even a person like that is destined for darkness. And if even she wasn't, then Voldemort wasn't, for his upbringing was no more tragic than hers. If his destiny ended up beyond redemption, it was because his own choices, over time, forged a mutilated character from which there was no escape. Character may be destiny, but this makes more sense and is more just if character is the culmination of a truly free set of choices, rather than the inevitable outcome of blood or fate. This possibility of true freedom, of goods potentially but needlessly lost, imbues the Potter books with an element of tragedy that's often a feature of great literature. Consider again Merope's tragic home life, physical, verbal, and emotional abuse, a condition of virtual domestic slavery, an absence of love and affirmation, an abundance of violence and meanness. None of this makes her ensnarement of Riddle right, but, and this is part of Rowling's nuanced moral analysis, it ought to soften our critical judgment of Merope, especially since, of her own volition, she eventually gave up using the potion. At the risk of losing the love of her life, her unborn child's father, and perhaps the first happiness she ever experienced, at the risk of rejection and terrible pain, pain that did in fact practically kill her with a broken heart, she did the right thing, choosing character over power, reality over appearance, forgiveness over resentment. And she chose love over hate, letting Riddle leave because that was his choice, despite her continued love for him. Indeed, because of her love for him. And despite Riddle's abandonment of her, she still named her son after him, so gracious was her character. Which reminds us of Dumbledore's eventual gracious response to Muggles, despite their cruel and devastating mistreatment of his sister. Voldemort, in contrast, chose to exact revenge for his father's abandonment by killing both his father and his grandparents, and by rejecting his Muggle name and heritage. The contemporary philosopher William Hasker offers an analysis of freedom quite relevant to Merope's predicament. All sorts of experiences and relationships acquire a special value because they involve love, trust, and affection that are freely bestowed. The love potions that appear in many fairy stories, and in the Harry Potter series, can become a trap. The one who is used the potion finds that he wants to be loved for his own sake, and not because of the potion, yet fears the loss of the beloved's affection if the potion is no longer used. Merope came to a crossroads in her short, tragic life. Through magic, she could continue to manipulate Riddle, or she could stop, though at great personal cost. Merope did the right thing. She gave up using her magical powers altogether after Riddle left her, refusing to use them even to save her own life. It might have been grief that led to the loss of her powers, but Dumbledore is virtually certain that instead she no longer wanted to be a witch. Perhaps she saw its potential for abuse, especially within herself, and she refused to indulge it anymore. She may have recognized within herself the call to the dark side, as it were, and realized that the best way to avoid it was by renouncing magic altogether, never again subjecting another to the sort of tyranny that she herself had been subjected to by her family. She had experienced firsthand what that led to, and no longer wanted any part of it. Certain behavior can skip a generation. The child of an alcoholic not uncommonly sees the ugliness of the addiction and reacts against it, perhaps by becoming a rigid teetotaler, and then his children react against that, and the pattern recurs. Merope so reacted against magic and its abuses, and retained such potential for love that she was willing to suffer and be vulnerable. Exhibiting what Voldemort could only think of as weakness, she was willing to fall prey to what he considered the worst thing of all, death. Merope chose the death of her body rather than the death of her character, and her own pain before the domination of another. Her love for Riddle had made her vulnerable to hurt and rejection, as all love does, and her aversion to hurting others the way she herself had been hurt contributed to her premature death. Not surprisingly, given her horrible upbringing, she lacked some of the good qualities that Harry's mother had, but nonetheless,
Merope did all that she could to battle the forces of unforgiving fate to break free from the pattern of magical manipulation and coercion. In this sense, Voldemort is radically unlike his mother, who, despite her tragic history, still retained tenderness of heart and the capacity for love, whereas Voldemort never loved another, never even had a genuine friend or wanted one. And this wasn't because of his tragic beginnings, and certainly not because of his mother's moral failing, but, among other reasons, because he rejected the pain, vulnerability, and weakness that caring for another as much as for himself inevitably involves. He wanted to be untouchable, and he got his wish, losing his very humanity in the process. Remember that Dumbledore said that he wasn't as concerned about the young Voldemort's ability to speak to snakes as he was about his obvious instincts for cruelty, secrecy, and domination. Voldemort's abilities didn't define him. His choices did, and sowing his choices reaped a character and a destiny of darkness. He might have chosen not to love in order to avoid dependency or weakness, but his habitual unwillingness to open his heart to another led to the loss of his capacity to do it altogether. What we see in Voldemort is a picture of where the definitive choice of evil and the rejection of love lead. A character in love only with himself, but who ends up harming and fragmenting himself in irredeemable ways. Tragically, Voldemort learned from the worst his mother did, rather than from the best, hating what he should have loved, and imitating with reckless abandon what she herself rejected. All of this, of course, only bolsters the contrast between Voldemort and Harry. So much of what distinguishes Harry from Voldemort is that Harry, despite his troubled past and tragic life, never loses his ability to love. He doesn't harden his heart and start to care only about himself. He doesn't cut himself off from others. Far more than Voldemort, he remains his mother's son. The mother whose courage and sacrificial love keep Harry safe from the worst Voldemort can dish out. Her love unleashes a more ancient and powerful magic than any potion can hope to imitate, or Voldemort can hope to defeat, or even understand. Chapter 6. Harry Potter, Radical Feminism and the Power of Love. Anne Collins Smith. Love is a force in the Potter universe that crosses hierarchical boundaries and defeats the powerful. And, curiously, love is most efficacious in combating evil in J.K. Rowling's world, when it makes no attempt to compete at all. Self-sacrifice and kindness bring unexpected rewards. Love and compassion overwhelm greed and ambition, overcoming them without attempting to defeat them. In other words, Rowling's world resonates with the values of radical feminism. Perhaps that sounds strange. So, to demystify this claim, we'll begin with a survey of contemporary feminist scholarship on Harry Potter, en route to an understanding of radical feminism, culminating in an examination of the role of love in the Potter books. The feminist debate so far. Feminist commentators are divided on Rowling's series. Two general schools of interpretation prevail. Those who consider the series sexist and those who consider it progressive. Some writers, such as Christine Schaefer, Elizabeth Heilman, and Eliza Dressong, have argued that the Potter books perpetuate traditional gender stereotypes and reinforce negative gender portrayals in the minds of young readers. Jimena Gallardo-C. and C. Jason Smith, in their joint article Cinderfella, offer a startling and exciting feminist interpretation of the motifs and symbolism in the series. But they, too, claim that the books are sexist, at least on the surface. Other writers, for example, Edmund Kern, Mimi Gladstein, and Sarah Zettel, have claimed that Rowling provides a balanced view of the sexes that includes strong female characters and an egalitarian magical society. They argue that the books are not sexist, and indeed offer good role models for young readers. Although these two schools of interpretation are generally opposed, they are not completely black and white. Dressong, for example, offers a highly nuanced perspective on Hermione Granger's capacity for self-determination, even within a society that Dressong considers patriarchal. Kern willingly admits that the books are slanted toward male characters, even as he disputes the fairness of some accusations of sexism. This dispute between the two schools of interpretation primarily focuses on the portrayal of female characters in the series. In Harry Potter's Girl Trouble, Christian Schaefer observes that there are no female characters in the series who approach the level of the male characters. No girl is brilliantly heroic the way Harry is. No woman is experienced and wise like Professor Dumbledore. Elizabeth Heilman argues that the books replicate some of the most demeaning yet familiar culture stereotypes for both males and females. Gallardo C. and Smith claim that the Harry Potter books resonate with gender stereotypes of the worst sort. In response, Kern, Zettel and Gladstein offer eloquent pleas for the importance of context. They acknowledge the existence of female characters who display negative traits traditionally associated with feminine stereotypes, but they also observe that there are numerous parallel depictions of male characters who display negative masculine traits. Kern observes, for example, that the silliness of Lavender and Parvati mirrors the juvenile antics of Dean and Seamus, and that Hermione's accident with the polyjuice potion should be read in parallel to Ron's accident with the slug-eating spell. Zettel points out that Madame Pince the librarian goes irrational when she thinks a student has written in a book, but then Filch the caretaker wants the students whipped and chained for littering. Gladstein juxtaposes incompetent Trelawney with fake Gilderoy Lockhart. Expanding on their point by referring to characters not available to some earlier commentators, these authors also point to villains such as Dolores Umbridge and Bellatrix Lestrange, who command as much fear and respect as any of the male Death Eaters. Among the various negative feminine stereotypes, the act of giggling is a lightning rod for feminist commentary. Dresong comments that the pervasive description of girls as silly, giggling and light-headed undermines Rowling's more gender-balanced depiction of girls' opportunities in the patriarchal hierarchy. Heilman states that this giggling undermines the sportsmanship of the girls who play Quidditch. Even as sports team members, the girls exhibit girlish behaviour by giggling at the possibility of playing with the handsome new captain and seeker, Cedric Diggory. Quidditch is not the only context for giggling. The second two books are littered with references to giggling girls. Zettel acknowledges such criticisms and offers a pointed comeback. Critics deride the girls at Hogwarts because they're shown to giggle and shriek and generally make a lot of noise. Some real-life girls do giggle and shriek. Some are quiet and serious. Some like pink and ruffles. Some like athletics and blue jeans. We see them all at Hogwarts. I reject the notion that we must tell girls that the only way to be valid human beings is to turn themselves into boys. Radical versus liberal feminism. Although Zettel does not identify herself as a radical feminist, her response to these critics highlights a major point of disagreement between liberal and radical feminism. Liberal feminism, historically grounded in the writings of Mary Wollstonecraft, 1759 to 1797, Harriet Taylor Mill, 1807 to 1858, and John Stuart Mill, 1806 to 1873, holds the once controversial view that women are people, that is, intelligent, autonomous beings, and should be treated as such. Sometimes characterized as first-wave feminism, the feminism of the 18th and 19th centuries drew inspiration from Enlightenment philosophers, emphasizing individual rights and responsibilities, and arguing that these should be applied to women as well as to men. The liberal feminist view that women are people may seem entirely reasonable, but in actuality is surprisingly problematic. There's an inherent assumption in liberal feminism that people is a gender-neutral term. But in fact, our concept of what people means has been shaped by a society whose intellectual life has long been dominated by men. Moreover, while liberal feminism is optimistic in its belief that women, given equal opportunity, will achieve equal status with men socially, politically and economically, it overlooks the possibility that women may have interests, strengths and abilities different from those of men, which may lead women to prefer different measures of success. There are examples of liberal feminism among both the supporters and the detractors of the Potter series. Gladstein, a supporter of the series, praises Professor McGonagall, who has succeeded in rising to a powerful position within the Hogwarts hierarchy. She also speaks in support of Hermione, whose logical acumen and love of learning fall into a traditionally masculine pattern of rationality and inquiry. These characters have succeeded on masculine terms, and their successes are rightly praised. Characters who have achieved different sorts of success, however, may not receive their full due within the context of liberal feminism. Gladstein, for example, highlights Molly Weasley's active and assertive participation in the Order of the Phoenix in the later books, but only briefly mentions her earlier role as a mother. We can also see a tendency toward liberal feminism in some of those who take a more negative view of the series. Heilman, for example, comments on Rowling's tendency to depict girl students in groups. This repeated grouping reinforces the idea of the sociological construct of the communal and friendly girl compared to the individual and competitive boy. She claims that this reinforces the inferior position of females, which suggests that she considers being communal rather than individual, friendly rather than competitive, as an indication of actual or perceived inferiority. This tendency of liberal feminism to downplay roles and traits traditionally associated with women is part of the reason that a different form of feminism, radical feminism, evolved as part of the second wave of feminism in the 1960s and the 1970s. Radical feminism takes its name from the Latin word radix, meaning root, and holds that the root cause of women's oppression is the sex-gender system, a set of social expectations that force identities onto people in such a way that a person's physical, sexual identification necessarily determines that person's personality, permissible social roles, and acceptable economic occupations. In a patriarchal society, these expectations will tend to privilege men and disempower women. For example, in the United States, within living memory, women used to be shunted into a handful of acceptable pink-collar jobs, such as nurses, secretaries, and school teachers. Although radical feminists disagree on exactly how to fix the problem, they often focus on the characteristics that are traditionally labelled masculine or feminine by society, and consider ways in which these characteristics can be freed from rigid categorizations, such as the following contrasted pairs. Traits traditionally considered masculine versus traits traditionally considered feminine. Control versus love. Independence versus interdependence. Individualism versus community. Hierarchy versus networking. Domination versus sharing. Competition versus cooperation. Aggression versus compassion. Reason versus emotion. Some radical feminists feel that our society would benefit from people in general becoming more androgynous, so that men and women could freely mix and match whatever characteristics appeal most to them individually. In this way, both men and women would become people. But our understanding of what people are would no longer be limited to the guidelines laid down by a male-dominated society. Other radical feminists feel that the values traditionally considered feminine would benefit our society most and should be adopted by men and women alike, thus shifting the definition of people to a more feminine-centric model. Some scholarly commentaries on the Potter series exemplify radical feminism. For example, Zettel emphasizes the importance of Molly Weasley's household management, pointing out that she's successfully raising 7 kids on a tight budget. Honestly, the woman should get a medal. In a more serious vein, Zettel argues that, for an author to show that only traditional male power and place matter, is to discount and belittle the hard and complex lives of our peers and our ancestresses. Zettel's willingness to praise female characters who have succeeded on terms other than traditional masculine ones would be welcomed by radical feminists. Another article that offers a radical feminist perspective on the Potter series is Giardo C. and Smith's Cinderfella. Although these authors criticize the gender stereotypes present on the surface of the series, they move to a deeper level to present a radical feminist interpretation of the good and evil sides of the conflict. The evil characters, they point out, display phallic power and ambition, and are aggressive and power-hungry. This would apply even to female characters such as Umbridge, who, despite her stereotypically feminine taste in clothing and office decoration, demonstrates an ongoing obsession with traditionally masculine values such as control, hierarchy, and structure in her takeover of Hogwarts, in Order of the Phoenix, and in her creation of her own bureaucracy to persecute Muggle-born magic users and Deathly Hallows. On the other hand, Harry's own choices and decisions belie a preference for the feminine, and his compatriots exhibit traditionally feminine characteristics such as kindness, selflessness, a desire for intimacy with others, and responsibility. In this way, these authors argue that Rowling associates good with values traditionally considered feminine, and evil with values traditionally considered masculine. This association of good with qualities such as love and compassion is something radical feminists have in common with earlier philosophers and theologians, who also felt that such traits needed to be integrated into our understanding and practice of humanity. From St. Gertrude the Great's emphasis on loving-kindness as an essential feature of God's nature and a crucial one for humans to imitate, to Gandhi's campaign of non-violent civil disobedience, in which he proclaimed that life without love is death, to C.S. Lewis's careful analysis of each of the various types of love as necessary for the fulfillment of humanity, many thinkers have emphasized the importance of traits such as love, kindness, and compassion. Radical feminists argue not only that these traits have been traditionally assigned to women rather than valued by society as a whole, but that this has been done in a particularly harmful way. Women are encouraged to be so altruistic that they don't stand up for themselves, and they submit meekly to traditional forms of oppression for fear that any attempt at assertiveness will be seen as a lack of femininity. Meanwhile, men are damaged as well, because living up to a macho ideal that emphasizes competition and independence is a stressful and incomplete way to be human. As Heather Booth, Evie Goldfield, and Sue Munica wrote, "As long as artificially constructed, mythically based images of masculine and feminine are the only alternative, both men and women are going to find conflict between their imposed sexual identity and their goals as human beings." More wonderful and more terrible than death. As mentioned at the outset, love, traditionally identified as a feminine characteristic, occupies a position of particular importance in Rowling's universe, and her depiction of it resonates with radical feminism. Again and again, we see Harry's capacity to love and be loved protect him from evil and enable him to protect others. We learn about the importance of love in the first book, when the love imprinted on Harry's skin by his mother's sacrifice saves Harry's life. Professor Quirrell, whose body Lord Voldemort inhabits, finds that he cannot bear to touch Harry because of the invisible mark left by the love of Harry's mother. This is the first example in the series in which we see that love resists evil effortlessly, without deliberate action on Harry's part. We then learn from Dumbledore that this same love saved Harry from Voldemort's earlier attempt to kill him in infancy. Love is not wielded as a weapon, it simply overwhelms evil by its very existence. This love, however, is extrinsic to Harry's own nature. In Sorcerer's Stone, he is saved by his mother's love for him, not by his own love for others. It is significant that this love is literally in his skin, on the outside, rather than, say, in his heart, on the inside. As the books progress, however, we see Harry's intrinsic ability to love others become more and more important. In Prisoner of Azkaban, Harry saves the life of Peter Pettigrew, not out of love for the traitor who betrayed Harry's parents, but out of love for Remus Lupin and Sirius Black. Harry does not want his father's friends to become murderers. He cares more about them than about his own desire for vengeance. The consequences of this deeply unselfish action are multiple. Ultimately, Pettigrew's debt to Harry saves Harry's life, although that was not Harry's motivation for saving him. In the later books, Rowling continues to emphasize Harry's love for others. In Order of the Phoenix, near the end of the confrontation at the Ministry of Magic, Harry is briefly possessed by Voldemort. Harry is not strong enough to repel Voldemort, and he resigns himself to the possibility of death. The thought enters his mind that death would reunite him with his beloved godfather. "And I'll see Sirius again." And as Harry's heart filled with emotion, the creature's coils loosened. The pain was gone. Harry does not deliberately set his love for Sirius against Voldemort's will. Had he done so, love would take its place as another weapon in the arsenal of masculine competition. Instead, Voldemort simply cannot bear to be in its presence. Once again, love overwhelms evil without effort. In explaining the incident in the Ministry of Magic, Dumbledore describes,
"A force that is at once more wonderful and more terrible than death, than human intelligence, than forces of nature. It is the power that you possess in such quantities, and which Voldemort has not at all. That power saved you from possession by Voldemort, because he could not bear to reside in a body so full of the force he detests."
This power, of course, is love. As Dumbledore explains,
"In the end, it mattered not that you could not close your mind. It was your heart that saved you."
Dumbledore's explanation demonstrates a preference for traditionally feminine characteristics over traditionally masculine ones, because reason, the power of the mind, is traditionally identified as masculine, while emotion, the power of the heart, is traditionally considered feminine. In Half-Blood Prince, Dumbledore states that love is the power the Dark Lord knows not, that is mentioned in the prophecy about Voldemort and his self-chosen enemy. Dumbledore further explains that this power is what kept Harry from succumbing to the temptations of the dark arts and from yielding to the more ordinary temptations of using his magical abilities to obtain selfish goals such as wealth or immortality. He is forced to explain these things to Harry because Harry does not realize them. Again, love has not functioned as a conscious barrier that Harry has deliberately raised in order to fight against these temptations, but as a quality within himself that keeps him from even being tempted in the first place. Love achieves even greater importance in the final volume, Deathly Hallows, functioning at multiple levels in different parts of the book. Harry's ability to love unselfishly is not confined to humans, but extends to loving other beings as well, which bears unexpected benefits. Remembering Dumbledore's critical remarks in Order of the Phoenix about Sirius's neglectful treatment of the house elf creature, moved by Creature's story of his dreadful journey with Regulus Black to replace the Horcrux locket with a replica, and stirred by Hermione's sympathetic explanation of Creature's psychology, Harry begins to treat Creature with kindness. As a result, Creature eagerly assists Harry in locating the real locket by tracking down the thief, Mundungus Fletcher, who is able to tell Harry its whereabouts. Harry's respectful treatment of the goblin grip hook also makes possible the recovery of an object that can be used to destroy Horcruxes, the Sword of Gryffindor. And, of course, Harry's constant kindness toward Dobby is rewarded when Dobby saves Harry's life at the cost of his own. Harry's most surprising act of love, however, is his attempt to redeem Voldemort himself. Harry's plea to Voldemort to feel remorse, with the recognition that this would enable him to heal and reunite the surviving fragments of his shattered soul, is an astonishing act of compassion that shocks Voldemort beyond any revelation or taunt.
"It's your one last chance," said Harry. "It's all you've got left. I've seen what you'll be otherwise. Be a man. Try. Try for some remorse."
Of course, Voldemort does not recognize Harry's appeal as an act of compassion. A hyper-masculine figure obsessed with domination and control, he fails to understand the genuine power of traditionally feminine values, a flaw that has already caused him to overlook the capabilities of house elves and the true motivation of his supposed ally, Severus Snape. Harry's choice of words here reveals a remarkable aspect of Rowling's worldview. When Harry urges Voldemort to be a man, he is implicitly claiming that Voldemort's actions to date have not demonstrated manhood, that Voldemort's hypermasculinity is not in fact true manhood at all. Instead, Harry's understanding of manhood is one that is fully human, incorporating traditionally feminine traits as well as traditionally masculine ones. As Terry Doughty wrote in her essay comparing the Potter series to other contemporary books aimed at adolescent males, the Harry Potter books do not problematize masculinity. In contrast to the protagonists of contemporary books that depict young men struggling with little guidance toward a violent and alienated adulthood, Harry has a number of positive adult male role models, such as Dumbledore, Rubus Hagrid, and Lupin, who do not hesitate to express traits such as reassurance or sympathy, and who are able to assure Harry that he is growing into the right sort of boy. In the Potter books, the right sort of boy, indeed, the right sort of man, is not only strong and brave, but kind and loving as well. Less surprising than Harry's attempt to redeem Voldemort is his willingness to yield his own life to protect the ones he loves. The outcome of this act, however, is also surprising to Voldemort. Harry is not, in fact, killed, and his act of sacrifice offers magical protection to his compatriots. Meanwhile, Harry's mastery of the Elder Wand contrasts sharply with the attempts by other wizards to obtain it. He never sets out deliberately to acquire it, and he does not intend to use it for destructive purposes. The only spell he casts in the final showdown is defensive. Harry does not engage in a duel to the death with Voldemort. The fact that he is successful without attempting to compete shows again that in this series, love is more important than aggression. The Triumph of Love. In Rowling's world, love does not enter into combat, which would mean that it was participating in and implicitly promoting the masculine structure. From a radical feminist perspective, when love overcomes hatred, it does so without deigning to enter into any sort of contest, but simply and naturally overwhelms evil by its very presence. Although the successes of Hermione and McGonagall may mark the presence of liberal feminism in Rowling's creation, the ultimate triumph of love and compassion over selfishness and ambition clearly provides an overarching worldview that is more in line with radical feminism. Part 3. Potter Watch, Freedom and Politics. Chapter 7. Patriotism, House Loyalty, and the Obligations of Belonging. Andrew P. Mills. When you enter Hogwarts in your first year, the Sorting Hat assigns you to one of four houses: Gryffindor, Slytherin, Hufflepuff, or Ravenclaw. Each house has its own colours, mascots, and traditions, and the houses form the social structure of the school. House members live together, eat together, take classes together, and compete together, on and off the Quidditch field, to win honour and glory for their houses. Being in a house at Hogwarts affects the way you treat other people. After all, we think that as a good Gryffindor, Hermione Granger should support the Gryffindor Quidditch team, help Gryffindor earn points toward the House Cup by doing well in class, and by helping Ron Weasley and Harry with their homework, and in other ways give preferential treatment to other Gryffindors. Indeed, if Hermione were not to care about the welfare of her fellow Gryffindors, or if she weren't upset when she cost the house points, we'd count that as a moral failing of hers. And worse, if she were to help Vincent Crabbe and Gregory Goyle, members of Slytherin, with their homework, or were to sabotage Harry's Nimbus 2000 so that Hufflepuff would win that week's Quidditch match, Hermione would rightly be accused of betraying her house and of being a disloyal and unpatriotic Gryffindor. One of the many things we admire about Hermione, Ron, and especially Harry, is that they are loyal and dedicated to one another and to their friends. That they are patriotic Gryffindors is one of their virtues. But is patriotism of this sort really a virtue? Many of us think that it is. What else would explain why we demand that our political leaders be patriotic, why we raise our children to love their homeland, and why we admire soldiers who risk their lives in service to their country? Yet in spite of this, there are some powerful arguments that claim that patriotism is a vice, that if we're in favour of patriotism, we're similar in important ways to Voldemort and the Death Eaters. So which is it? Is patriotism a virtue, a vice, or does it depend on the circumstances? The dangers of patriotism. Those who consider patriotism a virtue may be thinking that to lack patriotism is to be selfish. Patriotism, as the US politician and presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson, 1900 to 1965, once wrote, means putting country before self. A patriot might risk her life to defend her country and thus sacrifice her personal interests so that her nation might prosper. That a patriot should put her country's interests ahead of her own is admirable. But what should her attitude be toward the interests of other countries? Here, too, it seems the patriot should give preference to her own country's interests. Being a patriotic Gryffindor means that Hermione should sacrifice some of her free time to help Ron and Harry with their homework, so the house won't lose any more points. But it also means that Hermione should put the interests of Gryffindor ahead of the interests of the other houses. Similarly, being a patriotic American means preferring America's well-being over the well-being of all other countries. Thus, the injunction to buy American and so support the US economy. But it's just this aspect of giving preference to our own country over all others that causes the problems and makes patriotism look like a vice. The Russian author Leo Tolstoy, 1828 to 1910, called patriotism the desire for the exclusive good of one's own nation, and thought it was this very desire that produced war. Emma Goldman, 1869 to 1940, a Lithuanian-born social activist who spent much of her life working and writing in America, felt similarly. She wrote, "Conceit, arrogance, and egotism are the essentials of patriotism. Patriotism assumes that our globe is divided into little spots, each one surrounded by an iron gate. Those who have had the fortune of being born on some particular spot consider themselves better, nobler, grander, more intelligent than the living beings inhabiting any other spot. It is, therefore, the duty of everyone on that chosen spot to fight, kill, and die in the attempt to impose his superiority upon all the others." Patriotism thus seems to involve, if Tolstoy and Goldman are right, a Voldemort-like sense of superiority. Our nation is the best. The citizens of our nation are better than the citizens of other nations, and those other nations must serve our interests by giving us resources we need, or behaving in the ways we want them to behave. And if they won't do it voluntarily, we'll force them to do so at the tip of a wand or at the barrel of a gun. Death Eaters and Discrimination. We can appreciate this criticism of patriotism even more by thinking about the Death Eaters. Those in league with Voldemort believe that some wizards, purebloods they call them, are morally more worthy than other wizards, whom they derisively call mudbloods, and that muggles barely register on the moral radar. But any such view, which counts some subset of the population as morally superior to the rest, runs counter to a long tradition in ethics according to which acting morally means treating everyone, man or woman, black or white, Christian or Muslim, muggle or wizard, as having equal moral worth. Utilitarians, such as the English philosophers Jeremy Bentham, 1748 to 1832, and John Stuart Mill, 1806 to 1873, have some basic disagreements with the German philosopher Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, concerning the nature of ethics. Both camps, however, agree that a fundamental principle of morality is that all people are of equal moral worth. Utilitarians hold that actions are to be judged according to their effects on the sentient creatures, creatures who can feel pleasure and pain, who are affected by them, and all such creatures count equally, each to count for one, and none for more than one, as Bentham famously put it. The minister of magic's pain or pleasure is no more important than that felt by the lowliest house elf or the ugliest blast-ended scroot. Although Kant disagreed with the utilitarians over what it takes for a being to count morally, mere sentience wasn't enough for him, he did agree that everyone who matters morally matters equally. "To act morally, you must," Kant said, "act in such a way that you always treat humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of any other, never simply as a means, but always at the same time as an end. All people must be treated as beings whose life projects, their ends, are equally valuable, and no one should be used merely to serve the ends of someone else." Harry's allies know this. In the dark days described in Deathly Hallows, the hosts of the underground radio program Potter Watch remind their listeners to save their muggle neighbours from Death Eater attacks on the grounds that every human life is worth the same and worth saving. Hermione goes even further, extending this principle to non-humans as part of her tireless and thankless effort to liberate the Hogwarts house elves. Recall her horror when she realizes that the meals at Hogwarts are prepared by house elves, or, as she puts it, slave labor. To do something about the situation, she starts SPEW, the Society for the Promotion of Elfish Welfare. This principle of equality, however expressed, explains what's wrong with racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, and all other forms of discrimination. Each of these views violates the idea that everyone deserves equal moral consideration. White racists think the suffering of black people is of less importance than the suffering of white people. Male sexists think that it's all right for women to be subservient to men, and so on. But as Goldman and Tolstoy see it, patriotism is no different. After all, how is giving preferential treatment to your countrymen, which is what patriotism seems to require, any different from giving preferential treatment to those who share your ancestry or skin colour or gender? Doesn't the idea that we should treat all people as having equal moral worth conflict with the idea that some people are to be given preferential treatment because of some characteristic, such as race, gender or ancestry, they had no control over? It's justifiable to morally discriminate against someone because of something he or she has done, like using one of the unforgivable curses, but it seems unjustifiable to base moral worth on something he or she can't control, such as whether either of the person's parents is a muggle or which country the parent was born in. The Sorting Hat speaks. Division and divisiveness. So far, then, it looks like we must view patriotism as a vice, as the moral equivalent of racism or sexism, and that we must view the loyalty that Gryffindors show to their house not as something admirable, but as a position morally equivalent to the Death Eaters' view that only pure-blood wizards are morally worthy, and that wizards of mixed parentage and muggles are morally inferior. But there's another problem with patriotism, one that even the Sorting Hat could see. Patriotism divides us when we should be united. Solving global crises requires international cooperation, but such cooperation is difficult when we see other countries as our rivals. The Sorting Hat recognizes the problem with, well, sorting Hogwarts students at the beginning of Harry's fifth year. Though condemned, I am to split you. Still I worry that it's wrong. Though I must fulfill my duty and must quarter every year, still I wonder whether sorting may not bring the end I fear. Oh, know the perils, read the signs, the warning history shows, for our Hogwarts is in danger from external deadly foes, and we must unite inside her or we'll crumble from within. With division comes divisiveness, and what may have started out as harmless sorting for noble ends will end up as the basis for opposition and hatred. Think too of the Triwizard Tournament. As Albus Dumbledore describes it, the tournament is a friendly competition and is a most excellent way of establishing ties between young witches and wizards of different nationalities. But after it gets underway, Ron is unable to see Hermione's friendship with Victor Crumb, the champion from the foreign Durmstrang school, as anything other than disloyal behaviour. Because Hermione is friendly with Crumb, Ron accuses her of helping Crumb solve his egg, part of the second task of the tournament.
"I'd never help him work out that egg," said Hermione, looking outraged. "Never! How could you say something like that? I want Harry to win the tournament. Harry knows that, don't you, Harry?"
"You've got a funny way of showing it," sneered Ron.
"This whole tournament's supposed to be about getting to know foreign wizards and making friends with them," said Hermione hotly.
"No, it isn't," shouted Ron. "It's about winning."
With views like Ron's, it's no wonder that Dumbledore has to remind everyone of the point of the tournament, and that winning isn't it.
"The Triwizard Tournament's aim was to further and promote magical understanding. In light of Lord Voldemort's return, such ties are more important than ever before," Dumbledore says.
Indeed, Dumbledore sees that it is this very division that Voldemort banks on.
"We are only as strong as we are united, as weak as we are divided. Lord Voldemort's gift for spreading discord and enmity is very great. We can fight it by showing an equally strong bond of friendship and trust.
Dumbledore could just as easily be talking about the environmental threat posed by global warming, or the wars that grow out of many nations' thirst for more oil. Strong bonds of international friendship and trust are just as necessary in the fight against global crises as they are in the fight against